Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. On this Spotlight edition of the Future of Medicine podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Samuel Crosby. Dr. Crosby is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon specializing in hand and upper extremity surgery for both adult and pediatric patients. Dr. Crosby completed his medical degree and residency training at Vanderbilt University. He then obtained fellowship training in hand and upper extremity surgery at Harvard University. His work experiences include Brigham and Women's Hospital, Massachusetts General, and Boston Children's Hospital. He now practices in the greater Nashville area with Elite Sports Medicine and Orthopedics, providing comprehensive management of upper extremity concerns. In 2024, he was recognized as a Castle Connolly Top Doctor. Join us as we discuss pain management, the role of PRP and other injections, as well as surgical management of carpal tunnel syndrome, and much more. We hope you enjoy. Dr. Crosby, thanks for joining me on today's episode. I am really excited about having you on and having you as really an expert that you know I rely on very often for orthopedic needs, specifically the upper extremity. So thank you for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to doing this.
Yeah. So. And as we get into it, and as I kind of introduce you to the audience, tell us a little bit about kind of your journey into orthopedics and specifically what led you to want to focus on the shoulder and below.
Yeah. So like a lot of doctors, I kind of knew I wanted to be a doctor from a fairly young age and came to med school with kind of an open mind. And I think people tend to go either the surgical route or the non-surgical route. And I liked surgery. And when I started doing the rotations in third year of med school, I kind of found that orthopedics fit me well because it has a variety of ages of patients and activities of patients. And of all the things that I saw, it really gave you the best opportunity to help people with their quality of life, you know, really improve, you know, people. So got into orthopedics and decided that's what I wanted to do. And then in orthopedics, there are a bunch of different subspecialties. So back in the day, it used to be you'd go to a general orthopedic surgeon who'd do your back and do your knee and do your shoulder and do your hand. But really in the last 30 years, orthopedics kind of changed to having subspecialists. And so for me, hand and upper extremity, which is what I do, appealed to me because it's a lot of variety. You know, some people like the same thing over and over again. Well, there's always something new coming in my door and a lot of variety. It's a variety of ages. I see kids and adults. And really, there are a lot of different pathologies I treat. And so that's kind of what appealed to me about doing what I do.
Yeah. I remember those days. I, as you can imagine, pretty quickly decided medicine's my route, non-surgical. But I can remember those are the conversations you have in those first few years of med school. You know, where's the split going to be, surgery versus non? So
yeah.
Glad you found that route.
Yeah, people kind of figure out pretty quickly where they fit.
Yeah.
You know, you're still kind of immature. You're in your 20s. You don't know yourself that well, but it is. People usually end up finding the route that best suits their personality.
So, yeah, absolutely. Well, with our members at Brentwood MD and really primary care patients in general, it's so important to talk about fitness and physical exercise being such a crucial part of their health plan. What are, general question here, but what are one to two areas where you feel like patients can do a better job with their physical health? Maybe obviously skewed toward upper extremity thought processes there.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. You know, a lot of the difficult part of my job is keeping people active because from my standpoint, being active, exercise is so important from, you know, physical health, but also mental health. And a lot of the things I treat limit people's ability to stay healthy and keep exercising. So really the things I tell people, the number one piece of advice I'd give patients is activity modifications are huge. So listening to your body and letting your body tell you what you can and can't do. And there's a lot of ways around just simple aches and pains, or even, you know, tendonitis or arthritis. There are a lot of ways to modify workouts, modify the sports you play, modify your equipment to keep you active and keep you doing that, and also keep you out of the orthopedic surgeon's office, because they'll alleviate a lot of that pain that you're having and allow you to continue to be active.
Yeah. Now, that's great advice. And do you run into individuals where you feel like there might be some common mistakes they make with their upper extremity fitness?
Yeah. I mean, I would say the two biggest ones are, number one, not listening to their bodies, and number two, moderation. And when I say moderation, you know, exercising every day is fine. But if you play 4 hours of tennis a day, something in your arm's going to break down, whether it's tendonitis or arthritis of the wrist. And so, you know, cross training is really important, and finding ways to moderate the activities you love, still enjoy them, but not do them to the point of breaking something down. And a good guide to that is really pain. You know, when people are smart about it, if they are golfers or tennis players and have a little bit of pain, maybe take a week or two off, let it calm down, and be honest with themselves about what's hurting them and how bad it's hurting them, rather than just trying to push through it. They tend to do a lot better than people that push through the pain. A lot of times they'll end up in the office with a worse problem.
Yeah. So. No, that's great advice. And that's a great place to go next, where when individuals have pain, how should they be thinking about how to address that, you know, really at onset? And then maybe what's your thought on the ensuing days, you know, if pain persists? What type of recommendations would you have for individuals after they experience an injury or overuse?
Yeah. And there are a lot of different severities. You know, the normal aches and pains typically respond well to rest and anti-inflammatories. Kind of the bad pain will usually do three things. One is keep you awake at night. So if your pain is keeping you awake at night, keeping you from sleeping, you know, that's usually something that needs to be addressed with more than just anti-inflammatories and rest. And two is if it really makes you miserable, you have trouble working, it totally shuts down your activities, you know, that's probably something. Just the general aches and pains of when you start to get some soreness, do an anti-inflammatory rest, all the things that, you know, the doctor used to tell you back in the day, you know, that's generally a distinction of the types of pain that I see that people have.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, just, you know, severity. It'll definitely cross that threshold where it starts to interfere with life and sleep. That's a great recommendation, though, that if people are waking up with pain, that's a signal that their body needs something more than just the rest.
And that's the driver of a lot of people into my office is, you know, if it interferes with their job, if they're miserable or if they can't sleep at night, usually they'll end up, you know, finding their way to the office.
So maybe kind of next steps from there, how do you describe the benefit of physical therapy and really when to offer that in the setting of an acute injury that isn't responding to rest and so forth?
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on the injury severity. So, you know, clearly if you're playing a sport and you injure your knee and you have difficulty walking, that's probably something that needs to be evaluated by a doctor rather than just going straight to therapy. But if it's something that you just wake up with, you know, all of a sudden your elbow hurts or your shoulder hurts to lift things over your head, therapy's huge. And you know, the role of therapy is huge in helping alleviate pain. And they have a lot of new modalities in therapy that we didn't have 10 years ago to help with inflammation. And so, you know, they help with inflammation, they help strengthen the muscles around the joint that's bothering you. So I think therapy is huge, but if there is actually an acute injury, you know, you feel a pop, you feel a tear in significant pain, it's something that should be evaluated before you do therapy rather than just, you know, trying that first.
Gotcha. Well, and similar to that, the role of imaging. You know, sometimes patients will reach out to me and they'll say, well, I hurt something or something's aching, I need an x-ray or I'd like to get an MRI. Kind of what are your thought processes there, and how might that be maybe different than how you were talking about the severity and the role of other interventions?
Yeah. So with injuries especially, x-ray is a good screening tool. So, you know, mm-hmm. we do x-rays in the office. They're really quick. X-rays show, just for those of you that aren't familiar with it, they show the bones and the joints, but they don't show soft tissue. So tendon injuries, ligaments, things like that, you need an MRI. And with a lot of things, it depends on the acuity of the injury. So for like a fall, for instance, you know, that's going to be something we would screen with an x-ray. If you wake up with pain, we usually use x-rays as screening tools to see, mm-hmm. hey, is this joint healthy? You know, is this arthritis, which arthritis is wear and tear of the joint. And that's something that's probably not going to respond as well to therapy as, say, a tendonitis. So mm-hmm. if the joint's normal, you know, then that's something that we can screen. So usually mm-hmm. x-ray is kind of the first screen. And then if it doesn't respond to some of those modalities we treat it with, we'll get an MRI. Mm-hmm. Except for in the case of an acute injury, you know, if you were to rupture a tendon or tear a ligament or something like that.
Gotcha. Very good. Next question I often get is actually kind of circling back to the anti-inflammatories. And I'd love to get your thoughts on maybe the kind of the process of what to select. Mm-hmm. And so we'll start maybe with the topical agents mm-hmm. and even fairly recently, some over-the-counter topicals like the Voltaren gels, but even some maybe compounded versions of topical relief. Do those have much of a role in really your situation around maybe hand joint arthritis, wrist pain, some of the more superficial joints mm-hmm. and tissues?
Yeah.
Do those have a role for you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the way I view kind of medications we can treat bone and joint pain with is, you know, the big bucket of anti-inflammatories, so non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or NSAIDs. And those are all, you know, kind of similar, but they're recently, we've gotten one of the ones that we've used historically is over-the-counter, which is diclofenac or Voltaren. Mm-hmm. And so you're exactly right. I mean, for me, I find Voltaren works a lot better for the joints and muscles that are closer to the skin because the penetration is only so deep. So it'll work better. I mean, for example, hand arthritis, I find it to work pretty well for people mm-hmm. as opposed to shoulder pain, which is kind of a deeper joint. And it really doesn't have that penetration to treat it. I mean, mm-hmm. the reason we like topicals, you know, a lot of people today don't like to take medications because of the side effects. And we certainly see fewer systemic side effects from the topicals, which is why, you know, hand arthritis, tennis elbow responds pretty well to it because the tendons are right below the skin. But, you know, some of the deeper joints respond a little bit better to the oral mm-hmm. anti-inflammatories, you know.
Gotcha. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I think that thought of kind of avoiding oral medications is definitely to be considered. Mm-hmm. I do get a lot of questions and would love your thoughts on any natural supplements that may reduce inflammation that you feel like there's been either, you know, true scientific evidence or even anecdotal evidence behind their benefit for patients?
Yeah, certainly, you know, natural treatments, the big one that is out there is turmeric. So people take mm-hmm. turmeric, which is a spice that has anti-inflammatory properties. And generally, if you add pepper to it, it'll increase the uptake. So most of the formulations you'll see of turmeric or turmeric and pepper. And, mm-hmm. and I have patients that really respond well to that. So for people that are looking for more of a natural remedy, I would say the anti-inflammatory properties are not as strong as, say, an mm-hmm. Advil or an Aleve or a cousin of those, but they do work. And I'm a believer in anti-inflammatory diets. I think, you know, sugars and things we put in our body with inflammation certainly affect the way our whole body feels. And it may not cause deterioration of your joints, but certainly helps with the temporary inflammation that we feel, which can control pain and things like that.
Yeah.
So I believe in an anti-inflammatory diet too. But that's a hard thing to do, you know, in today's day and age mm-hmm. when we're all busy. It takes a lot of discipline and work to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, though. I mean, working with individuals for a variety of needs, but obviously thinking about their orthopedic and musculoskeletal health, I always do still come back to their nutrition, their fitness, their sleep, you know, things that without those being appropriate, their body is going to be more prone to inflammation mm-hmm. and therefore to pain. And maybe it didn't cause a problem like arthritis, mm-hmm. but it could irritate or aggravate that. And so mm-hmm. it's always great to look back at some of the foundations of health and make sure those are in order as you then layer in additional treatments. So yeah, thank you. Any role for glucosamine? I know that's one that's been around a fairly long amount of time. Any benefit there?
Yeah, so that's a natural supplement that is thought to have some help in joints. I mean, I tell patients it's worth a try. I mean, the downside to trying it is low if you're really trying anything natural. I'm not sure how beneficial it is for a lot of the pain I see, but I have had patients just anecdotally that love it. So for people who are trying things, I mean, that's probably, I first, you know, recommend turmeric and glucosamine chondroitin. And especially for arthritis type pain, that's one that I will tell people. I'll kind of write it down and say, hey, you can try this. I'm not sure how much, you know, scientifically it's going to do, but anecdotally I do have some people that swear by it, and it's worth a try.
Yeah, absolutely. Back to the NSAIDs. So obviously the over-the-counter Motrin, Advil, ibuprofens. Then you get into many of the prescription options. Tell me your thought process there. You know, a handful to choose from, maybe more. How should I be thinking of that as a prescriber for reducing inflammation?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think they all really work by the same mechanism, and a lot of the different formulations and medicines, the way that we prescribe it depends on how long they stay in the body or their half-life. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it for me is dosing. So high-dose ibuprofen, 800 milligrams of ibuprofen 3 times a day, that's what we give for prescription-strength ibuprofen, which is the generic name for Advil, as you know. But I think it works really well, but it's hard for people to remember to take pills 3 times a day. And so the other ones I typically use are meloxicam or Mobic, which is a once-a-day pill, which is kind of nice. You know, you wake up in the morning, you take it once a day, or if you have pain at night, you know, kind of take it before you go to bed. And Celebrex, which, you know, is probably a little more selective. It may not have quite the GI side effects, which, you know, for those of you who aren't aware, all those medications can cause stomach irritation with gastritis and ulcers. Celebrex is thought to maybe be a little bit milder on the stomach. And so for people that have a history of gastritis or something like that, a lot of times I'll try Celebrex. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it, I'll talk to the patients about their dosing. And if there's somebody that just needs an anti-inflammatory before golf that they play once a week, I'll do like an 800 milligram of ibuprofen because it doesn't have quite it doesn't stay in your system as long, and that can get them through the golf. But if it's somebody that I'm going to put on a consistent anti-inflammatory because I want them to see that benefit of taking something consistently, I'll do something with a little bit easier dosing like Celebrex or Meloxicam.
Okay, great.
And everybody I give those medication to, I try to remind them, watch your stomach. Mm-hmm. And then also watch for leg swelling. So especially for older patients, you know, we see renal kidney issues with taking those for a long time. So over 65, I try not to give them for more than 6 months. And anybody that has any issues with kidneys, we got to be pretty careful with them because it can affect that. But for most young people with healthy kidneys, you can stay on them for a long time and not have those issues, as you know.
That's a great reminder too, but when you think of a lot of the common options, the meloxicam, diclofenac, or even the higher dose ibuprofen, do you see any change in that side effect profile as far as GI irritation? Obviously, the Celebrex kind of in its own class, but of the kind of classic NSAIDs, are they all pretty much the same in your mind?
I mean, this is non-scientific. This is just what I've seen. But I think that diclofenac's a little harder on the stomach. I tend to see more stomach issues with diclofenac. Meloxicam's probably in the middle. And then naproxen and ibuprofen aren't quite as bad. But you can certainly, I think there's some individuals that are just predisposed to having that gastritis or stomach inflammation and ulcers. That's the way I see it. I don't know if that's right or not, but just, you know, in my experience, that's what I've found.
Yeah. So. No, I appreciate that insight because my thought would be I've seen it with all of them.
That's right. Absolutely.
And I don't know if I have identified in my practice where one kind of has leveled to the top of, oh, this is a little more risky than others. So it's nice to get your thought as much as you're working with people, obviously in pain, pretty consistently and talking about NSAIDs.
Yeah. But chronically. Full disclaimer, I totally agree. I think there are some people that are just predisposed and you can give them any of them and they're going to have issues.
Yep.
Yep.
Very good. Now, as we move away from kind of the NSAID management, and this is an area where I am pretty ignorant when it comes to injections. And obviously, we'll kind of stay focused on the injections you'd be aware, you know, accustomed to with upper extremity injury. But tell me about the role of injections. Obviously, thinking maybe more of the classic things that our listeners would be aware of, like steroid injections. But are there any other prescription injections that are beneficial to your patients?
So I use injections a lot, and the idea behind injections is it gives you a powerful dose of anti-inflammatory right in the area where you hurt. So as opposed to taking an oral steroid, as you know, we do the injections to decrease the inflammation locally. And steroids are probably the most common ones I do. And of the steroids I do, there are different steroids I use for different pathologies and different problems. The side effects of steroids, you know, people always ask about that, especially in diabetics. It can make your sugar go up. And then just locally, when you give a steroid injection, you can have what we call depigmentation, or a little bit of lightening of the skin in the area. And then fat atrophy, which means kind of the fat below the skin dimples up and goes away. And so the way to think about steroids is the stronger the steroid, the more of a chance that there's going to be a side effect in the area just locally. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the steroids I give in the hand and wrist are some of the milder ones with side effects, because a lot of the joints or, you know, areas are right below the skin. And if you have those side effects, they're going to be visible. So one of the steroids I use is betamethasone, which is kind of a middle of the road strength and middle of the road side effect profile, but works really well in the hand and wrist. And I give it for things like arthritis. So put them in the joint for arthritis, mm-hmm. Put them in the tendon sheath for problems of the tendons. We see a lot of tendonitises in the hand, that respond well to them. And so that's kind of how we use injections. And some injections are just used to provide temporary relief to try to get people through the bad times. And some injections of steroids are actually curative, like for a trigger finger, which is a problem of a tendon in the hand. About 50% of people that get those injections, it cures their pathology. So there are some steroid injections that will actually, you know, cure the pathology. So that's some of the thought process on the steroid injections. Mm-hmm. And then beyond those steroid injections, which we give for those purposes, platelet-rich plasma is another injection we give. So platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, is an injection we give. We do it in the office. We draw people's blood, spin it down in a centrifuge, and then take the parts of the blood that help your body heal itself and inject it into an area. Mm-hmm. And that's being used more and more today. When you look at the effectiveness of it and kind of the whole idea behind it, it's almost the opposite of steroids. Whereas, you know, a steroid's an anti-inflammatory injection, PRP is a pro-inflammatory injection, so it generates inflammation. And the idea behind that is it recruits those parts of your body that heals itself to help heal, for instance, a chronic tendinopathy like tennis elbow. And so that's kind of another injection we give. And then people also do stem cells. You know, stem cells are another type of pro-inflammatory injection, or you know, meant towards regenerating tissue. I think a lot of the use of stem cells is the same as PRP, just kind of drawing your body's attention to an area and trying to get it to heal.
Glad you went there. I was really anxious to ask you about some of what I would maybe call the non-traditional therapies that maybe are becoming a little more mainstream with PRP and possible stem cells. So thanks for touching on that. And I'd love to actually dive in a little deeper. Even, would you say PRP might be what you utilize most in your treatment plans currently?
It is. I mean, there's a lot of appeal to the buzzword of stem cells, and a lot of people cling to that. And I have a lot of people come in my office and ask for stem cells. You know, I think the technology now is not such that the stem cells will actually generate the type of tissue that you want, such as cartilage in an arthritic joint. I think a lot of the benefit of the current stem cell injections we give is, like what I said, putting the inflammation in the area and trying to get your body to heal it. And stem cells injections are more expensive than platelet-rich plasma injections. So for me, well, around the country, stem cells are very controversial, not from an ethical standpoint, but just from a, is this useful enough to justify the extra cost? And for me, if somebody wants to go that route of having something short of surgery that's not a steroid injection, I usually do platelet-rich plasma just because it's more cost-effective. And I think the usefulness is pretty on par with the stem cell injections.
Gotcha. Well, that's good. And correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of to summarize what you mentioned is they're both going to be pro-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. And so they're both kind of working down that same pathway for your body to kind of wake up and say, hey, let's bring inflammation into this area for a good purpose to heal. And like you said, there's some cost benefit, there's some ease of access and familiarity with PRP that is exceeding stem cells. That be a fair way to
say it? And until there's really solid research that proves that stem cells are actually more effective than PRP, I'm not sure it justifies the extra cost and hurdles that you do to get through to stem cells. So yeah, it's more accessible, it's more cost efficient, and stem cells have not proven scientifically consistently to be better than PRP.
Yeah. So. No, that's great. Well, and that's the great thing and the terrifying thing about the world we live in, where what we're saying today, 10 years from now, we may say something else.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean we're wrong today. It just means the times have changed. The science has changed. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, 10 years ago, PRP was fringe.
Yeah.
It was, you know, something that, you know, you had to really have a specialized center to access, and now, like you said, you're doing them there in your office.
You're exactly right. And I start my conversation about arthritis with a lot of times with the phrase, like, we can't generate cartilage within a joint yet. We may have that technology in 20 years, we may have it in 50 years. That'll be a game changer. But now there's no way we have to actually put true cartilage back on the end of bones and cure arthritis. So, but it's an exciting time to be in medicine because things are changing, you know, rapidly.
Yeah. I'm glad you view it as exciting, because sometimes it can be terrifying, because it's hard to stay up on things.
Yeah,
you know, I'll constantly, things will be brought to my attention that are so new. Mm-hmm. And possibly popular, that you don't have the time in residence to really know, okay, hey, is this grounded in science? Is this grounded in data? Or is this just the new hot thing? And so it's a constant battle in my practice. So, so Dr. Crosby, now what I'd love to do is kind of focus on maybe some specific common ailments that I see. But before I get into the common ones that I see, what's probably the most common ailment or diagnosis of the upper extremity that you work with frequently?
Yeah, I would say kind of three specific ones are carpal tunnel, tennis elbow, and arthritis. So those are probably the three most common things I treat.
Gotcha. Let's talk about arthritis first. What joint do you primarily work with arthritis, or is it all of the above?
So I do everything, you know, shoulder to fingertip, I do all the arthritic joints. But the most common one that brings people into my office is basilar thumb joint arthritis, or arthritis at the base of the thumb. So essentially where the thumb meets the wrist, you know, just so we're on the same page for all the listeners, arthritis is basically wear and tear of the cartilage. The cartilage is what's on the end of joints, end of bones that create the joints to allow them to glide smoothly. And as we all age, that starts to wear down. And so the most common one that finds its way into my office is basilar thumb joint or thumb CMC arthritis.
Okay.
And that is essentially where the thumb meets the wrist. When people grip something tightly or squeeze something, you know, pinch something tightly, about six times the force on the tip of the thumb goes into the base of the thumb. And so that's pain and swelling. And it's really common because obviously we use our thumb in almost everything we do.
Yeah.
So.
Gotcha. Kind of what's the treatment plan there?
Yeah, a lot of what we talked about. So generally we'll try the one non-invasive treatment that's been shown to be effective is bracing. And we have some special braces we use just for this type of arthritis. So we'll generally try bracing and anti-inflammatories. If that's unsuccessful, or if people are sufficiently miserable, we'll try steroid injections in the joint.
Okay.
And about 85% of people that come in with that problem can get through without any type of surgical management. There is a surgery to fix it, but that's kind of a last resort, you know, if all the other stuff fails.
Yeah. You know, actually going back to that thought that we had earlier when we were talking about the medication management. So if you run into a situation like that, I feel like two likely outcomes will be somebody just starts taking ibuprofen and let's say it helps and they just continue it over and over and over. And then you could run into the long-term chronic challenges of GI health, hypertension, kidney issues. Would you recommend those individuals before they get way down that path to undergo an injection? Would that be beneficial to that plan?
Yeah, it depends on the severity of symptoms. So for me, I mean, I always tell people arthritis is like a bad roller coaster. There'll be times where you don't even think about it and it's not bothering you, and then there'll be times when it's really bad. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it depends on the cadence of those bad times. You know, how often are you miserable? How often are you having that bad pain that kind of stops you in your tracks?
Yeah.
And so, you know, if it's somebody who has every couple weeks it's flared up and then it's good for a month, you know, those are people that could try the anti-inflammatories before mm-hmm. the injections. But, you know, kind of some of those first things we talked about, if it's keeping you awake at night, if it's making you miserable, you know, that's generally when I'll give an injection. Because, you know, steroids, too many of them in a joint can start to deteriorate the joint. And so mm-hmm. I tell people kind of keep that as your ace in the hole if your pain gets really bad. So, a lot of it, I know that's a long answer, but a lot of it depends on how bad their symptoms are, yeah. how often it's bothering them, and can they manage it with those kind of first-line treatments. Mm-hmm. And usually I'll try that first, but there are a lot of people that come in my office and they're like, I'm miserable with this thing, I can't use my hand, and those people are the ones that typically get an injection first.
Okay. No, that was a great answer, because one of my fears as a primary care doc is always, you know, somebody may either self-manage or under my direction manage with anti-inflammatories, and it works. Mm-hmm. But then they may be on it very consistently for a long time. And then you kind of wonder, well, did I miss something? Was there something mm-hmm. that could have been done by mm-hmm. a specialist sooner that may have saved them from prolonged anti-inflammatories? And like yeah. you said, and going back to how you even opened our discussion, is listening to your body mm-hmm. and severity of symptoms is so important.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I think, you know, the relationship that's made there, even if the symptoms are mild, I think it's good for the specialist patient relationship just to come yeah. in and say, hey, we're going to try some stuff short of surgery, we're going to go, you know, with some of the non-invasive things first, and it helps with the relationship rather than people coming in and extremists mm-hmm. and it makes it, you know, more difficult to generate that trust of the relationship, because then people are like, you know, do surgery or cut my arm off, you know, and mm-hmm. and by that time you know, it makes it kind of more difficult. So I think early referral to a specialist, then, you know, you get the diagnosis, you get some good counseling, and a lot of times I can kind of counsel people and give them braces and talk to them about how to avoid activities that are going to bother it, that'll even keep them out of my office, which is good. So there's I think prevention goes a long way from that mm-hmm. standpoint.
Very good. Well, let's move to that next topic. Tennis elbow, mm-hmm. I think, was the second one you mentioned.
Yeah.
So kind of walk me through that. What can somebody who, well, explain that to us, because it's not just for tennis players
yes.
or pickleball
yeah.
players, I'm
yep.
sure now. So yeah. yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, so tennis elbow is a really bad name. So it doesn't have anything to do with tennis. And a lot of people come in and they say, well, I don't play tennis, I don't know why how I have this. But it's basically a tendinopathy, which is a wearing out of the tendon or degeneration of the tendons. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's from overuse and sometimes it's just unavoidable. It's a part of the natural aging process. You know, as we age, we see some tendons start to wear out. And specifically with tennis elbow, it's the tendons on the outside of the elbow. And it's the ones that are responsible for cocking your wrist back. And the difficult part about that is you use those wrist extensors in almost everything you do. So any power grip, so simple things like lifting a coffee cup, lifting a Yeti or Stanley, you know, a lot of times people have problems with that. But it affects you and it can be really miserable. And that's because the tendon actually starts to degenerate and tear off the bone. And that's a scary thing to hear and a scary thing to tell people. But the good news is it can usually respond to non-surgical management. But that's what tennis elbow is.
Gotcha. So. Yeah, so how should someone kind of initially manage that
mm-hmm.
on their own? And maybe once they come in to myself or maybe an urgent care and they get diagnosed and then they get mm-hmm. sent to you, what's kind of the first step they can do
yeah.
on their own?
Yeah, so some of those things we talked about earlier is just like activity modification. So mm-hmm. lifting with your palm down, that's what we call pronated lifting. That's going to put the maximum amount of stress on those tendons. And it's felt in the form of pain, so people usually know when they're doing those activities they're going to bother it. So avoidance activities is the first thing I tell people, because that's a very low risk intervention. I usually have them sleep in a wrist brace. So mm-hmm. wrist braces, you know, a lot of people wear those tennis elbow straps, the counterforce braces.
Yeah.
I'm kind of 50-50 on those. I don't usually even prescribe them because a lot of people don't think they work. I can tell people they can try them, but I'm not sure on the effectiveness of those. But sleeping in a wrist brace takes the pressure off those wrist extensors when you sleep at night, mm-hmm. and it's a pretty low risk intervention you can start with. And then therapy is actually really useful for tennis elbow. So they do some exercises to help strengthen the tendon, keep the range of motion there, and they can do some of those anti-inflammatory modalities to help. And that's usually kind of the first line treatment.
Great. Great. Well, next area I'd love to touch on, and probably thanks to the sports of the world, everything that affects the shoulder gets labeled rotator cuff, which I'm sure is not accurate.
That's right.
So kind of walk me through shoulder pain.
Yeah.
And also rotator cuff, as that is a common thing. But thanks to all the pitchers and quarterbacks out there, it's not all a rotator cuff, even though that is difficult for athletes. So
yeah.
How should a patient be thinking about shoulder discomfort?
That's, just broadly, there are some things we see in younger athletes, like, you know, football players and pitchers. And then there's other things we see in older patients, which are more those kind of degenerative things. There's kind of, if you're talking about kind of the older degenerative processes, I'm assuming, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So one of the first distinctions is kind of, is it frozen shoulder or is it a problem mm-hmm. with the rotator cuff? So frozen shoulder is a problem that comes on spontaneously. It's very common. And people just get generalized pain in the shoulder and they start to lose motion. And that is something we see that's kind of different from rotator cuff pain. Mm-hmm. It's generally dull like a toothache at all times and it hurts in the maximum of motion, and you see that motion slowly get less and less. And so that's one thing that affects you other than rotator cuff problems. You know, rotator cuff problems are typically, you know, pain with overhead motion, pain when sleeping at nighttime. Mm-hmm. And just so everybody's on the same page, you know, the rotator cuff is a series of muscles and tendons that surround the shoulder that's responsible for a lot of the motions of the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And we see traumatic tears of the rotator cuff, meaning, you know, you can sustain an injury to the rotator cuff from a fall. And you can also just have a degenerative tear where you don't do anything wrong. You just kind of wake up and start having shoulder pain. And that's the hard thing for people to grasp, is sometimes frozen shoulder and degenerative tears of the rotator cuff just happen spontaneously, not necessarily from an injury or an activity.
Yeah. That's a good reminder, too, of kind of the sudden aspect that even chronic conditions, degenerative processes, can actually mm-hmm. have more of a sudden onset.
Yeah, and that's a hard thing for people to really wrap their head around, because,
sure.
I mean, the way that our minds work as humans, we like to link, you know, bad problems and bad results to certain activities, and it's not mm-hmm. necessarily always that. You know, people come in all the time, and they're like, oh, I spent too long in the garden. Well, the truth is, you know, it could have happened if you were sitting on your couch. I mean, sometimes some of these things just, you know, the body wears down.
Yeah. Well, the last condition I think you mentioned a few minutes ago, carpal tunnel, mm-hmm. I believe. So kind of tell me about that and how somebody can be thinking through that process.
Yeah, so carpal tunnel is essentially a pinched nerve in the wrist. And what the symptoms look like is it's numbness and tingling. Generally starts when you sleep at night, you wake up with a numb hand and you kind of have to shake it out. Mm-hmm. And then it progresses to daytime symptoms and things like driving, reading a book, and holding your wrist in a position for a prolonged period of time cause numbness, tingling, and pain. And, you know, everybody, when they hear carpal tunnel, it's kind of, the first response is, oh, I don't type that much. I'm not on a keyboard that much. That's kind of been disproven to be a big part of the carpal tunnel causation. So carpal tunnel is not necessarily from keyboarding. A lot of it depends on your body composition, your genetics, and just the lifetime of use. I mean, certainly those people that have a repetitive gripping occupation are a little predisposed to it, but there are a lot of factors that lead to carpal tunnel syndrome. So it's definitely multifactorial in what causes it. And so, you know, the numbness and tingling that wakes you from sleep at night is usually the first symptom. And we'll generally have people sleep in a nighttime brace. And the idea behind the brace is it just holds the wrist in a neutral position to keep mm-hmm. your wrist from flexing or extending, which, you know, when that happens, it increases the pressure in the tunnel and cuts off the circulation to the nerve. And that's why you experience the tingling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's usually the first intervention we'll do on carpal tunnel.
Yeah. Tell me about the surgical intervention there and when that has a place.
Yeah. So we'll usually start with nighttime bracing, and then if it persists despite that or if it progresses, we'll talk about kind of the two options: injections, which is kind of a temporary relief, and then surgery. So surgery, the idea behind the carpal tunnel surgery is essentially all you do is go in and open up that tunnel. So you just increase the volume of that tunnel. So going in and cutting the roof of the tunnel, the two sides spread apart, and it increases the volume about 25%. Okay. And there's a couple ways to do that. You can do an open carpal tunnel release, which is kind of the classic way. You know, you cut the ligament from the top. I've moved to mostly doing endoscopic carpal tunnel releases, which is just a less invasive way of cutting the ligament, where you essentially make a small little 2-centimeter incision in the forearm and go in from the inside and open up the tunnel from the inside out.
Okay.
But when you do that, it does increase the volume in the tunnel and usually fixes it for life. So the lifetime risk of recurrence of carpal tunnel is very low. And it's by and large a very successful surgery for getting rid of intermittent numbness and tingling and helping with the pain, you know, at nighttime and when you hold your wrist, you know, for a prolonged period of time in the fingers.
Yeah. So I remember this, I guess, a personal story via my dad, who had the carpal tunnel surgery probably, I don't know, 7 or so years ago. And he had developed it pretty significantly and even had the thenar atrophy of some of the intrinsic hand muscles. And I really ask this because I want to make sure that I'm right in thinking about this, where the surgery can really stop the progression of symptoms, but doesn't the healing and the recovery of maybe strength in some of those intrinsic muscles, if it's gotten to that point where you've lost it, you don't really regain that.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, the way I counsel people on carpal tunnel is a little different from arthritis and tendonitis, which, you know, for those types of conditions, usually surgery is a last resort. We try everything. We exhaust all options. And surgery is for people who just really can't stand it. Well, with carpal tunnel, it is a progressive problem. And once you progress beyond a certain threshold, you know, the changes that you undergo with carpal tunnel can be irreversible. And so when I see people in the office, the two things I tell them to watch out for are constant numbness. So if you start with just, you know, it goes to sleep intermittently and then it progresses to constant, that can be an irreversible change. And then, like you said, that thenar atrophy or loss of the thumb muscles. So when you start to lose manual dexterity, and if you notice that your thumb is starting to look smaller, that is another sign of an irreversible change of the nerve. And when I say irreversible, what I mean is, you know, when it's intermittent and when there aren't those muscular changes, it gets 100% better. It's one of the most successful operations I do. When the nerve starts to undergo those changes, the nerve actually starts to die to where you can open up the carpal tunnel and the nerve doesn't regain, you know, doesn't regenerate, and you don't regain that strength and you don't regain that sensation.
Yeah. Now, thanks for reviewing that, because I know in my father's condition, I guess he was a little too beyond that point. And so he'll still hand me a bottle of water to open.
Yeah.
You know, just because that twisting and strength motion isn't as strong there. And I've always wondered when that happens, I'm like, oh, I wonder if he should have had the surgery a little sooner.
Yeah.
Must have.
Yeah. And there are a lot of, you know, you hear everything out there. And there are a lot of people that say carpal tunnel surgery doesn't work. And usually that's why they have a relative that let it progress beyond that point of being numb all the time and had a, you know, somebody they knew, you know, had some loss of the thumb muscle. So really the only carpal tunnel surgery, I mean, as far as a technical operation goes, it's really straightforward and pretty straightforward to do. And so usually those people that say their carpal tunnel didn't work, either the diagnosis was wrong or it had progressed beyond, you know, that point.
Yeah. Now, that's a great reminder, too, of just expectations of what successful surgery looks like. You know, if you catch it early and you don't have those irreversible changes, 100% successful.
Yeah.
But if you're past that point, the expectations are different. Where
and sometimes even halting the progression. So some of those people that may have that numbness all the time but still have some sensation and still have some strength to their thumb, I mean, I'll just tell them, you know, we're doing this to halt the progression. We're not going to make it better. It's not going to be a high five in clinic a week later because everything feels normal, but it is doing some good to stop that progression. And sometimes that's all you can do when it's gotten to that point.
Well, Dr. Crosby, thanks. We've covered a lot of ground. I know our conversation could go so much further into the details of other surgeries that you do, which maybe one day we'll get into. But as we land the plane on today's episode, I love when I talk to specialists, kind of asking them this general question that just allows them to look both back and forward at their career. So we'll start by kind of looking back, and what may be something that you maybe were either trained to do or to think maybe 5 or so years ago that you no longer think, because maybe science or your experience has shifted that mindset.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I used to do a lot is the injection for Dupuytren's contracture. So are you talking about generally or specifically?
Either. If that's where your mind goes immediately, let's go there.
I would just say that our industry, reps from industry and meetings is really good at filtering through what works and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And also having colleagues do the same thing and discussing it with them. And I would say, you know, specifically one thing I think of, you know, what am I not doing now that I did 5-10 years ago is definitely there's an injectable medication. It came out, you know, 15 years ago. Well, yeah, 20 years ago now almost. For a condition called Dupuytren's contracture, you'll see it advertised for on the TV, you know, with John Elway on football Sundays. The industry is very prevalent, but I've stopped using that as much because I have not felt it to be, you know, quite as successful. And I think just generally the biggest changes in the pattern of my practice and what I believe, I mean, a lot of the kind of principles I believe have not changed that much, but the technology continues to evolve. And as we go to meetings, we find out that these things we thought, you know, worked may not work that well. And there's new technologies that are working better. And so, you know, every few years there's a technology that I adopt that really is a game changer in terms of recovery from surgery or making it minimally invasive. And so that's kind of, in surgical practice, that's the biggest thing. I wouldn't say that there's something that I was dead certain about was the case, you know, 5 years ago, and now I've totally changed my mind. I'd say it's more of a kind of tapering towards those new technologies.
Mm-hmm. Went along that line, looking ahead, looking forward, is there anything you're excited about kind of on the horizon in your specialty of orthopedics that you are seeing kind of get closer to maybe affecting your practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two things are the minimally invasive techniques continue to get better. Our scopes get better that we can see through. Our instruments get better, particularly for the shoulder. The implants get better. We now have medications that do nerve blocks, and so when you have a procedure that's painful, we'll do a nerve block where they give you a shot up in the arm and it makes your arm completely numb for, it used to be 12 to 16 hours, but now they have nerve blocks that kind of make that pain not begin until about 2-3 days after surgery, and that's huge at minimizing the narcotic use, because, you know, one of the things we deal with is just, you know, how many narcotics to prescribe, pain pills to prescribe, and those nerve blocks have helped a lot, and also helped with us kind of minimize anesthesia. You know, that's the other benefit to the nerve blocks we're doing, is everybody realizes that anesthesia has an effect on your brain, and so a lot of times we can use those nerve blocks to do regional anesthetic to where you just have a little bit of sedation rather than going under general anesthesia, even to have a big procedure. So,
gotcha. Well, last thing is I'd love for you to kind of tell us how our listeners can get in touch with your practice at Elite and how they can, you know, involve you in their care or one of your colleagues should they need it.
Yeah. So my practice is Elite Sports Medicine. We're located in, you know, the Midtown area, Brentwood, Franklin, Green Hills. And really our practice is pretty accessible. I mean, you can just kind of call the main line and request one of our doctors. I mean, I really stand beside my partners. I trust them all and like them all. And, you know, for orthopedic care, in my mind, you just can't get much better. So, yeah, no referral is needed to get into our practice, and we all kind of practice in a similar manner. So
that's
a great place to be.
Well, I can echo that from a referring doc's perspective that y'all always do so amazing at the communication and the access that patients can either have via us or directly. So that's a great asset to the greater Nashville area. So thank you. And once again, thanks for sitting down with me to talk about these things. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This has been good.
Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.